Okay, great. Okay, today, my final talk, what I'd like to describe to you is the other aspect of the paper that I talked about last talk with Bernd Sturmfels. And again, it concludes a series of papers, at least it so far concludes a series of papers, one of which I was on with Irena Pava, and the other Bernd wrote with Irena Pava, all on the same idea of these ideas coming from optimization through the connection that toric ideals give us with polytopes. And what I want to show you today is something that we call the Hull resolution. And from a purely algebraic geometry point of view, this might not be the nicest resolution, because when you're doing algebraic geometry, you attach religious significance to the minimal resolution. You know, these Betti numbers, you know, that are measuring the homology classes on these simplicial complexes, K sub B and so forth, you know, we think that that's the right information, and that any other resolution is somehow wrong if it is larger than that resolution. But when you try to do work in other areas, or even in algebraic geometry, you know, the kind of effect that you run into if you say, write down the equations of the Grassmannian, which is, you know, the set of all, the variety of all k-dimensional subspaces of an n-dimensional space. It has incredibly beautiful equations. But then if you try to just by hand, I mean, there are people who've done this in very sophisticated ways, but if you forget, don't look in the literature, just as an exercise, try by hand to write out some nice syzygies on those, and then try to write some nice second syzygies on those. Then at a certain point, you end up in a situation where you have a five-dimensional space that you would like to write down a basis for to continue the process you're doing. And there are six natural vectors for which they're nice and sparse, you know, mostly zero, and they mean something to you. And if you're going to follow the combinatorics, even within algebraic geometry, your intuition is, I want to take all six because, you know, I'm trying to study nature without casting a shadow on it. You know, it's very easy when you're doing math. All you see is your own shadow because you muck things up so much with arbitrary choices. And so that tells you to take all six. But this sort of religious point of view that the minimal resolution is it tells you to choose five of the six. The minute you choose five of the six, you polluted the natural symmetry of the problem with an arbitrary choice. And that just sort of corrupts it back further. You go two steps further in the resolution. You have no clue what's going on. Okay? So I've tried various other, there are, of course, better ways of looking at that particular example. But if you want to apply Betti numbers and syzygies to problems, you know, more combinatorial in nature, such as, you know, the talk that we had by Anders Bjørner yesterday, then there's a certain interest in following the symmetry of a problem rather than making minimal basis choices. Another aspect of the Hull resolution I'm going to show you is that this is a connection with polytopes. And there's an entire body of knowledge about polytopes, very little of which has been brought over to understand commutative algebra better. And so what I'm going to show you is a resolution that is occasionally minimal. I mean, in nice classes of ideals, it's minimal. But it's often non-minimal. But it's always choice-free. It always preserves the natural symmetry of a problem. And it comes from a convex Hull. I mean, it comes from the bounded faces of a polyhedron, or in many cases, it comes from a polytope. And so it gives you a bridge, and I'll end the talk with a simple example where there are entire schools of thought on both sides of the bridge as to what special classes mean, and perhaps this connection would tell us how to go back and forth. Okay, so I want to begin by working with monomial modules. So this is the definition that we introduced yesterday, where I work in the Laurent polynomial ring, where I allow arbitrary integer exponent vectors rather than just non-negative integer exponent vectors. But you can think a monomial ideal I sitting inside the ordinary polynomial ring. And for many applications, that's fine. But my technical goal here is there's a reason why this is in the same paper as the universal cover construction yesterday, is that I want to define the Hall resolution for a monomial module and get for free a Hall resolution of a toric ideal. And so I'll just mention briefly that that's possible, but that's why we're, but there's nothing about the combinatorics or convexity theory that ever makes reference to the fact that we're in the first orthic. So it's completely natural to study this for monomial modules anyways, even if we didn't have this application to periodic monomial modules. Okay, so now what I want to do is I want to fix a value of t which is greater than n plus 1 factorial. This is for technical reasons. It's just a precise version of saying take t large and look at behavior for all values of t neighboring infinity. This is just a statement of what is large enough for that problem. And now I want to define the space t sub t to be the convex hull of all vectors t to the a, which is going to be my shorthand for the vector. T is just a number, so t, or think of it as a single variable if you like, t to the a1 comma t to the an. So this is like a bold a and a light t. But I'm considering this precisely for all monomials that lie in my monomial ideal or my monomial module. And the first basic lemma is that P of T is closed precisely if this is, you know, the right class of monomial modules to be thinking about. You remember briefly yesterday I mentioned that we wanted to rule out an infinite decreasing chain with respect to divisibility. In particular, T itself is such a monomial module, but there's no set of minimal generators. You think of anything that might be a minimal generator, there's something even smaller that divides it. So we want to, you know, the one part of the theory of monomial ideals that we need to retain is even if there's an infinite generating set, we need to be able to think of our module in terms of monomial generators. So this is a closed space, this convex hull. If M is generated by its minimal monomial. In other words, it's clear what it means for monomial to be minimal. It means there's no other monomial that strictly divides it in M. And in the cases I want to rule out, there are no minimal monomials, or they don't generate M if there are some. There aren't enough. Okay, so this lemma is proved in the paper, but I'll just leave that aside as a comment that we're only interested in this class. But the first proposition I want to actually prove to you is this is a reasonable structure. This set has reasonable structures. We can map combinatorics of the polyhedron to the vertices, to the generators of our ideal. So we're in this case. You know, where this lemma holds, okay? So we're basically going to say that the vertices of the closed polyhedron P sub T correspond one-to-one to the minimal generators of M. Okay? So the way to see this is it's a short proof, and it's an argument we're going to need twice. We're going to use the same idea exactly in another proof. Okay, so first of all, let's suppose that x to the a belongs to m is not a min generator. Then you can find a chain. You can find, you know, some x to the b which divides, multiplied by some variable xi, x to the b, which we'll call x to the a, but that divides xi squared x to the b for some I and for some x to the b lying inside m. Okay? So that, you know, the idea is we have this sort of straight line chain of divisions that traps the monomial x to the a in the middle in the monomial ideal. So how does one think of that straight line geometrically? Well, it is a straight line geometrically. It corresponds to a line that looks like this, where we have the line t to the a, and then we have the line t to the a plus 2ei. Ei is just the standard vector with a 1 in the ith spot. Okay? And then our monomial, t to the b, is somewhere in this line. Not t, yes, exactly, thank you. I spoonerized a and b, right? So this is, the endpoints are t to the b and t to the b plus 2ei, and then t to the a, which we write as t to the b plus ei, is in the middle of this line segment, is a line contained in the polyhedral cone P of t, because all three of these monomials belong. So if you're in the middle of a line segment inside a convex body, you're not an extremal vertex of that convex body. So that's one direction. Okay. The second direction is the construction we're going to borrow again. If instead x to the a belonging to M is a minimal generator. Okay. What does this mean algebraically? I mean, what I enjoy about all these dictionaries is it's easier to keep. It's easier for the algebra to mean something if I can relate it to a polytope I can see, and vice versa. I mean, if I can make the link between what the algebra means and what the geometry means, I understand both better. So let's first write down what this means algebraically. What this means algebraically is for any x to the b different from x to the a, which is also in M, bi is greater than ai for some index I. I mean, if you had a distinct monomial whose exponents, coordinates were individually all less than or equal to ai, that would mean that x to the b divided x to the a. But we know that that's not the case because we're assuming that x to the a is a minimal generator. Okay, so what does that look like? Well, we take a vector v, which is t to the minus b, and compute. Okay, so v dot, I'm sorry, t to the minus a. I did that again. Okay, so v dot t to the a, so let's first look at what happens at our generator. Our generator is represented in the polyhedron P sub t by the point t to the a. So v dot t to the a is just t to the minus a dot product t to the a, which is, when you look at what the dot product does, it just sums a bunch of ones and calculates n for you. Okay? But now, if you look at such a x to the b, you know, we're looking for anything else which is a point in forming our convex body, then v times t to the b is equal to t to the minus a dot t to the b. And now that's going to be each of these, each of the individual pairwise products is strictly positive. So if we just focus on the ith coordinate, we get t to the bi minus ai, right? Which is at least 1. The exponent is at least 1. So this is greater than t, which has been assumed, this is at least greater than or equal to t, which has been assumed to be greater than n plus 1 factorial, which is greater than n. Okay? So what's the picture that goes here? We have the hyperplane v dot x equals n, and it's contacting the point x to the a we're interested in, and the rest of the polyhedral cone, you know, is above this hyperplane. So we found a supporting hyperplane for a minimal generator of our ideal, and we have proved that it is impossible to find such a supporting hyperplane for any other generator of the ideal. Okay, so that's that proof. Okay, so the next, I'm just proving a couple theorems, and I'll get right to the punchline, and then we're going to look at examples. So the next theorem is that the combinatorial structure of P to the T and the bounded faces, for that matter, which I'm going to define to be Hull of M. Okay? The Hull of M is going to be defined to be the subcomplex on the boundary complex of P sub T, which is the set of bounded faces of it, is independent of T for T greater than n plus 1 factorial. Okay? So, first of all, we've been studying partially ordered sets or posets. So, you know, what does one mean by the combinatorial structure? I mean, surely as you vary T and watch this in computer animation, you know, the shape changes, right? I mean, it's sort of things, certain faces zoom out and in and so forth. But the incidence, the way in which different faces meet each other, is what we're claiming is the combinatorial structure. And so one way of formalizing this is you define a poset whose elements are all the faces of P sub T, and whose less than relationship is containment. One face is contained inside another. And so one way of saying this more formally then is that the poset associated to P sub T and the poset associated to the bounded faces is independent of our choice of T. Okay. We've also mentioned matroid theory as a generalization, combinatorial generalization of bases for a vector space. Matroid theory, by the same token, can be used to describe polytopes. And there's a theory of oriented matroids. There's a five-author book which covers this that include Bernd Sturmfels and Anders Bjorner, who spoke to us as two of the five authors. And you know, one point of view there is, you know, that the combinatorial aspect of a basis of a vector space in an ordered field, such as the real numbers, is just, instead of knowing the exact values of all sorts of determinants, you simply look at the signs of the determinants. Are the determinants zero? Are the determinants positive? Are the determinants negative? And if you think about the situation of a polytope, then if you form, you know, think of a polytope in three dimensions. You form a facet which spans a two-dimensional plane. And to know the combinatorial structure, you'd like to know for other points whether they're in that plane, on one side of that plane, or the other side of that plane. And the sign of a determinant can tell you. You get a determinant whose value is the volume formed by a simplex with that point as you float it around. But if you don't care about the volume, just the sign, is it positive, negative, or zero, you can tell all sorts of combinatorial questions like that. So here, the way we get that sign information is we form an n by 1 by n by plus n plus 1 by n plus 1 matrix, and the matrix is going to consist of zeros along the bottom row in the left half and ones along the bottom row in the right half, and then the left half are going to be various vectors EI. Perhaps not all of them. In fact, there isn't room to choose all of them. We also want to use all n columns just for this purpose. And then the right half, we do various vectors t to the ai. And now there's clearly not room to do all of them. If we're, for example, thinking of an infinite periodic monomial module, it's infinitely generated. This matrix goes, you know, forever if we try to list the whole thing. But I'm just interested in a particular minor of sort of the infinite matrix you might have in mind for this problem, or large finite matrix if it's a monomial ideal, that the determinant, if you take the sign of the determinant, it's either greater than zero, less than zero, or equal to zero. We think of it as plus, minus, zero. You know, that this the set of sign information for such a determinant if you, as you vary the choices of the E's and the T's, tells you the combinatorial structure of this polyhedral cone. And in particular, as a special case, you can tell which spaces are bounded by where you move this wall, you know, how many EIs to use versus TIs. So proving this statement comes down to proving that this is the determinant here is a polynomial is a Laurent polynomial in T. So what we prove is that such a Laurent polynomial in T has all its roots less than n plus 1 factorial. It's just a basic expansion for determinants. Once we know it has all its roots less than n plus 1 factorial, then from there on, unless it's identically zero, from there on it's either always above zero or always below zero, and we get the independence of the combinatorial structure. So I'm not going to go through the details of that argument, but I did want to describe how it hooks up with posets and oriented matroids, so I think that's interesting. Okay, so now I want to give our main theorem before I do examples. Hull of M with the vertices labeled by the min generators of M supports a cellular resolution of M. So this is the bridge between polytopes and syzygies. We don't necessarily get minimal syzygies, but we can think of this as a polytope, or we can think of this as a resolution. And this is the bridge that I want to consider. Okay, so we have a very short proof which belies the effort we put into trying to understand the situation. Okay, this is how these things happen if you talk long enough about them. So what is it? I mean, these is exactly the kind of cellular resolutions we've been looking at the whole time. Like, I drew you a picture of the real projective plane that involved six pentagons gluing together. That was a cellular resolution of a certain ideal. I mean, so it's that kind of cellular resolution. We'll do examples. Okay, so now what is it we want to prove? Soren presented a criterion which tells you when a cell complex labeled by monomials gives you a resolution. You know, what is the exactness criteria? We want to prove that, so let's call this X, that X, the full subcomplex of all faces supported on vertices, you know, with vertices that are less than or equal to some degree B, is acyclic for any degree B whatsoever. And since we're in polytope theory, we should be able to come up with a rather simple proof that it's acyclic. And in fact, a nice way that acyclic simply means it has no homology groups, a nice way of showing something is acyclic is showing it's contractible. It's a point, you know, then nothing's going on. Okay, so this is easy just by checking special cases until X has at least two vertices. I mean, a line segment is really the first case we need to consider. I mean, that's also clearly acyclic. But let's, just for technical reasons, let's assume it has at least two vertices. And I want to look at the hyperplane v dot x equals n. Look familiar? That's the hyperplane we used up there to show that the vertices were the minimal generators. I'm going to use the same hyperplane, but now for a degree which is not a degree of a minimal generator. It's above at least two minimal generators. I'm going to slice P sub T by this hyperplane and see what happens for V equal to T to the minus B. Okay. So you check, one checks by exactly that kind of argument. If X to the A divides X to the B, which is the same thing as saying that T to the A is a vertex of X less of the subcomplex we're checking, X less than or equal to B, then an elementary calculation will say that V times T to the A is less than N. I think I'll obscure the essential simplicity of this. I'll do the calculation again, but you can see how it goes. It's the same idea as over there, except now, you know, the most you get in each coordinate is a 1, but at least somewhere, this has to be a strict division. If there are at least two vertices, then the degree B is the least common multiple of the degrees of at least two generators. So it has to be bigger than any one generator, so there's a strict division. So when you sort of repeat that argument, instead of getting 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals n, you get 1 plus 1 plus some fraction a few times, and so it adds up to less than n. Okay? Okay, and the flip side of this, otherwise, and what I'm saying is T to the A, not a vertex of P sub T, for X to the A, a minimal generator of M. If you repeat the same calculation, what you get is V dot T to the A is actually strictly greater than N. Because how did this escape dividing the degree B? It escapes dividing the degree B because in at least one of its coordinates, it had an exponent greater than the corresponding exponent of B. And now the same proof that showed that everybody but the minimal generator was above works here and says everybody but the vertices of this set is above. So this is a separating hyperplane. So the picture we have let's draw a picture. We have like four vertices, and then you know the picture sort of continues up like this. Let's say that this whole thing is P sub T, and you know out here there are other vertices. This is sort of the mental model you should have, and that these four vertices are the four vertices of X less than or equal to B. And in fact, the way I've drawn this, I've drawn X less than or equal to B as being the union of two triangles. In general, there's no reason this be simplicial. It'll be a cell complex, but you could easily get pentagons and so forth. And what have I done? I found a hyperplane which cuts through and separates X less than or equal to B from the rest of the vertices of P sub T. So what I want to do now is make a projective transformation, and I want to move this hyperplane to infinity. I mean, just make this hyperplane at infinity. And forget about the stuff on this side of it. I mean, look at the stuff on this side of the hyperplane when I move that hyperplane to infinity. And what is the stuff left? It is a polyhedral cone. Or it's a polyhedron, not necessarily a cone. It's a polyhedron, and X less than or equal to B is precisely the set of bounded faces of that polyhedron. Everything else runs off and meets infinity. So it's a standard fact from polytope theory that the set of bounded faces of polyhedron contracts to a point. So that shows that this is acyclic, and that's all we needed to check to prove the theorem. Okay. So now I want to do examples. Okay, the first example, so this construction is our algebraic interpretation of a construction that has been studied for a long time by Herb Scarf, as I mentioned, as a mathematical economist working in optimization theory. And, you know, so the example I'm going to show you is an algebraic version of the way anyone who looked at this in either theory would think of it. Yeah. Okay, you're asking what is a projective transformation?
I guess I am.
Yes, okay.
I mean, maybe I should just go read that. But
what's the easiest way of saying that? I mean, you should think of this whole space as being the hyperplane at z equals 1 with respect to a new coordinate z. And then you start doing linear out. You're just making linear transformations there and see what happens. So yeah, I mean, just if you picture it that way, okay, I mean, just picture, I mean, let's do it in the plane, okay? You've got a line in the plane, and you'd rather that line be the line at infinity, right? So you take your whole picture, you make that plane the plane at z equals 1, and you just cone that whole picture. So instead of have every object that you draw in the plane, you're replaced by the set of lines through the origin, which go through those points in the plane. Having formed that picture, you just move the plane z equals 1 to some other plane. So in particular, the line that we would like to be the plane at infinity, it cones out to a plane in this picture, cut by a plane parallel to that plane, and you won't see that plane anymore. That plane is the plane at infinity. Okay, so that's the easiest way of saying what we're doing there. Okay. Yes? What do you mean? Well, in the finite case, since we know it's closed and we know that the vertices correspond to the generators, which is finite, we're in reasonably good shape. In the infinite case, it gets technical, and basically it's hidden in this assumption I'm making about having a nice monomial module, is that another characterization of these nice monomial modules is that if you look in any particular degree B, there are only finitely many generators dividing that degree. So even though it's infinite or infinite periodic in our application to toric ideals, you know, we can still visualize it sort of small piece by just looking at the stuff underneath a certain negative orthant, okay? And now that proof tells you that the stuff underneath a certain negative orthant slid around is just a finite situation we can imagine. So our fears go away, you know. But that's, I mean, we had to worry about that too. Good that you ask. I am slurring over stuff that if you read the paper, you know. Okay, so let's look at an example, okay? The example that I want to look at is the ideal I, which is a cubed, a squared, b squared, b cubed, sitting inside the polynomial ring in two variables, a and b. Okay, and if I draw this ideal in our usual manner, then I have a generator here for a cubed, a generator here for b cubed, and a generator here for a squared b squared. And if I draw in the usual manner the solid body, which is everything inside the monomial ideal, I get a picture like this. And what you notice in particular is that if you were to directly take the convex hull of this monomial ideal, you would notice that this middle generator is not a vertex of the convex hull, okay? And there is a notion, if you can look, for example, in Eisenbud's book on commutative algebra, I mean, a special class of monomial ideals, integrally closed monomial ideals, have the property that they contain all of the monomials inside their convex hull. But even then, it's like an integer linear programming problem. The convex hull, you know, maybe sliding by without going through certain monomials and so forth, you know. So in our natural coordinates, we don't really get good convexity understanding of the monomial ideal. But here, it's enough to simply even take t equals 2. And if we take t equals 2, we can see what Scarf's construction is doing for us. Okay. And the idea, so here's the four, it's going to really basically scale my exponents 0, 1, 2, 3 to 1, 2, 4, 8. So 1, 2, 4, 8. The idea is that somehow instead of using a linear step scale to have an exponentially increasing step scale is a better way to plot ideals. And then when you plot ideals in an exponentially increasing step scale, then convexity does tell you what's going on. That's really an algebraic interpretation of Scarf's insight. So we draw it here. You get a point here, that's 8, 1, 1, 8, and then 2, 2 squares to 4, comes out to a point here, and you've got this line, you've got this line, you can see that just barely, but nevertheless true, we get piece of T that looks like this, and this corresponds to A cubed, this corresponds to A squared B squared, this corresponds to B cubed, and the hull would consist of these three vertices and these two edges. And I've done many times in this 2 weeks, I've written down resolutions by looking at such a drawing, so I won't actually write down the resolution one more time for this example. They are in the notes that will be on the web. But I leave that, you can see as an exercise that you actually get the minimal resolution of this ideal if you take this hull complex. And you can see how this exponential rescaling popped out the vertices so we could actually get away with getting a simple a complex to look at. Okay. Okay, so there are various applications I wanted to, there's various relationships I wish to discuss with this. So first of all, this generalizes the scarf complex in the earlier paper with Pava and Sturmfels. And I just want to briefly tell you the idea there, since you can see how it generalizes it. One thing that seems like an odd thing to try at first, if you're working with monomial ideals, is to relax and back off the integrality constraints on the exponents of an ideal. In other words, I mean, we've drawn lots of solid geometric pictures of ideals. But, you know, when you're doing algebra, I mean, you know, x squared y cubed means something. X to the 2.3 doesn't mean a whole lot when you're over a finite field or, you know, and so forth. So one tends not to consider moving exponent vectors away from the integer lattice points. But if you're trying to look at the geometric arrangement, you know, if you're trying to consider the information in the exponent vector set, if you weren't sort of coming at it from the point of view that you should never leave integrality, it's an interesting thing to try to let a set of exponent vectors just sort of wander around a little bit in real R-dimensional space. And what happens? I mean, so now we go to analogies from other fields. I mean, this is considered patently obvious in the theory of polytopes. If you have a special polytope, it might have a pentagon as one of its faces. But the minute you allow the vertices to sort of wander around in general position, the minute any two vertices sort of get out of whack with the other three, instead of having a pentagon, you've got three triangles. And so the general fact is that for generic positions of vertices, you have a simplicial polytope, and that the non-simplicial situation is actually very special. So it was a long-standing problem to try to understand the resolutions. It still is a long-standing problem to understand the minimal resolution of an arbitrary monomial ideal well. But the observation in this paper is that if you look at an ideal which is, even though it has integer exponents, it is generic in the sense that you could imagine that the exponents wandered off in the general position with respect to each other, then the hull complex, in this sense, has an entirely combinatorial description. You don't need to consider any of this geometry. And it gives you a simplicial minimal resolution of the monomial ideal. So the definition is the following. A monomial ideal I in n variables, x1 through xn, is generic. I just told you the intuitive idea of what we're trying to capture here. But is if and only if no two non-zero exponents of minimal generators agree in any coordinate. Okay? So the consequence, if you look at the set of papers together, is that the hull resolution is minimal. In other words, the hull has become simplicial, which is why you can give an entirely combinatorial description of it without resorting to convexity theory. And in some sense, the difficulties in understanding minimality for arbitrary monomial ideals go away by being in general position like this. So I want to give an example of that. So you can see, this is a very simple example to see how this works. I'll go up one dimension. It also shows something that, you know, it's not always the case that the Hall complex is pure dimensional. I mean, it may not be a pure complex, and in fact, it means special things when it is a pure complex. So the example I want to look at, which is a generic ideal, is to take I equal to a cubed c squared, a squared c cubed, abc, and b squared. And now this is an ideal sitting inside abc. Okay? So now let me draw this for you briefly. Okay, so I just want to pop up one. You should try drawing it for yourself. I mean, this it's like driving. You never saw a driver get car sick, right? It's only the passengers, right? I mean, it's much easier to see these drawings when you're drawing them, when I'm drawing them. So, you know, it's the actual motion your hand goes through as you're making the things. I find it's helpful to pop out a cube if I want to, like, sit at a certain point that's not in the, on the plane. Let's see. So I got this point here. I got this point here. This point here. So here are the four generators of my monomial ideal. A cubed, c squared. This is my a axis, my b axis, my c axis, and a squared, c cubed, abc, and b squared. Notice that I'm allowing these to share a zero exponent, but I'm not allowing them to share non-zero exponents. And in fact, the quickest way of checking that this is indeed generic is to write down columns giving you the exponent vector. So this is a column 302, this is a column 203, this is a column 111, this is a column 020. And now the columns are the generating exponents. And now genericity can be interpreted as simply saying the rows have distinct non-zero entries. And as we don't, it's sparse. This is a sparse notion. We don't worry about zero entries. In fact, one looks at first syzygies to generalize this to n dimensions. To generalize this to the periodic case, where we look at a monomial module which is infinitely generated, then in the monomial module case, we have to wean ourselves from the walls of the first orthant because we're no longer considering the first orthant. So we need an equivalent definition to this, which applies without reference to the first orthant, and there is one. So this is generic. Now the Hall complex, you rescale this thing, and it turns out you can already just see it here. Combinatorially or via the definition I've given you today, the Hall complex consists of a triangle with a line segment sticking out of it. And this supports, again, a minimal resolution by our theorem in BPS. It supports a minimal resolution of the monomial ideal. Okay. So one reason I wanted to mention that is I really like the idea of considering monomial ideals with real exponents. I mean, there's a lot, you know, it seems odd, but one gets some mileage out of it. Okay. Okay, so the next thing I want to consider is I just want to briefly remark toric ideals is used yesterday's S mod I sub L M sub L construction. To get a Hall resolution of S mod I sub L. Okay? I'm not going to actually do any examples of that, but we get that for free because we have the dictionary and we have a theory which works for monomial modules. Okay, so now the rest of the talk I want to consider a case which is sort of an intersection of what everyone's been talking about, you know, our guest speakers, Soren and I, which is square-free monomial ideals. So their quotient rings, F mod I, is a Stanley-Reisner or if you're Stanley writing a book, you call this a face ring, which is another nice name for it, because it's the faces of the simplicial complex somehow. So we have I in n variables, and it defines X, the simplicial complex. Sitting inside delta, which is all subsets of 1 through n. Okay? So something special happens here. We don't need the T rescaling. I mean, that we're looking at exponents e is equal to 0 or 1, then T to the e is equal to 1 or T. You know, you really just plot, when you start plotting the generators of a square-free monomial ideal, for any value of t whatsoever, you're simply just picking two places. You're drawing a cube whose vertices have coordinates either 1 or t in all entries. And you're sort of plotting, you're picking various corners of that cube as your way of plotting the exponents of your square-free monomial ideal. But it doesn't matter what cube you take, you get the same convex hull when you do this hull complex. You might as well just take the original cube, just take the standard unit cube. So hull of I is equal to the bounded faces of the convex hull of I itself. Okay. So in other words, by which I just mean, you know, plot the, this is a standard trick in combinatorics, which we're applying here, is just plot, you know, anytime you have an interesting set of 0, 1 vectors, plot them, take their convex hull, and see what happens. Okay? So now there's an even better special case. The special case is all generators, all minimum generators of I have the same degree. Okay? And if we're in that case, then if we take the convex hull of just the minimal generators of I, again, plotting their exponent vectors, it's a polytope. And it's a polytope inside the plane x1 plus xn equals d, if the degree is d. If all the generators have the same degree d, then if you add up the ones in their exponent vectors, you always get d. Therefore, here's a plane, hyperplane, sitting in Rn. So, you know, here's Rn, here's a hyperplane, and inside that hyperplane is some polytope. Well, that polytope is the set of bounded faces of the polyhedral cone. I mean, you don't get any more minimal generators as you go up out from this. So the original complex P sub T has this polytope as its set of bounded faces. It just emanates out from that polytope. So this is the polytope equal to hull of M, hull of I. So that polytope for square-free monomial ideal, all generators the same degree, defines a resolution of the ideal. So we can apply algebra to it, we can apply polytope theory to it. And we should get ideas by going both directions. So I want to do two examples. Okay, first I want to revisit an example that we did earlier last week, And the example we did last week was the real projective plane. Okay? And so I'm starting with a three-pronged thingy, attaching pentagons to it, and then making sort of nice flat pentagons along each side. Okay, that's how I drew it. And so opposite vertices and edges on the border of this are identified with each other antipodally, is how I get the real projective plane. And one thing we considered last week is that in characteristic not equal to 2, this gives a resolution of a certain ideal, which you can think of as being associated. It's an ideal whose Stanley Reisner ring was sort of a polar version of the same, with a triangulated RP2, which you could think of as polar to this RP2, just in the usual sense. Draw the dual graph, you get a triangulation of RP2. So rather than write down the 10 degree 3 generators, which were square free in 6 variables, so we have an ideal consisting of A, D, F, and 9 compatriots, 10 generators, degree 3, sitting inside 6 variables, A, B, C, D, E, F. I mean, it's fairly meaningless for me to list the actual list of generators. It's much better if I tell you the algorithm by which you can always compute them on the back of an envelope without remembering what they were, which is to draw A hat, B hat, C hat, meaning drop out those variables, and then draw D hat, E hat, F hat. And then if you want to pick a particular spot and decide, what the monomial is that goes with that vertex, let's consider this vertex here. That's really the same as this vertex here by identifying antipodes. And so you can see that this vertex can't have B in it, can't have C in it, can't have F in it. Therefore, moment, technical difficulty here. F hat here, E hat here. Okay, can't have B in it, can't have C in it, can't have E in it. Therefore, it's the monomial A, D, F. And you can label all the other 10 monomials in the same way, by just leaving out 3 things and taking the other 3 things. So I think that that's a much more meaningful description of what they are than my listing them for you. You can now list them with that description. Okay. Well, the Hull resolution is not minimal. And that's not too surprising, because the Hull resolution makes no reference to characteristic. And the minimal resolution of this ideal depends on characteristic. But moreover, this is a highly symmetric object, and any minimal resolution one writes down in characteristic 0, for example, makes arbitrary choices. In characteristic 0, this is the resolution. And this is, you could say this is pretty symmetric. But what happens in characteristic 2? I mean, in characteristic 2, there are 2 more syzygies. And one of them corresponds to choosing a cycle on this RP2, which is not contractible to a point. Just any cycle, such as this cycle here. Okay? So that really is a closed curve, because it starts and ends at the same point, but it gives the non-zero homology class in characteristic 2 twice it is 0. You do this twice, it's a closed loop on the sphere, and you can just pull it back to a point. But once, it isn't. So the Hull resolution, since it preserves symmetry, has no way of choosing this particular cycle or any other particular cycle that would work equally well. It has to make some choice which is totally symmetric. And in fact, we can give a precise description of Hull of I is 5-dimensional. So in fact, it gives a resolution that's much longer than the minimal resolution, even in characteristic 2. And it has 22 facets. Okay. Now, it turns out that if you draw the 22 facets, then there are six facets which look like going around in closed loops that are contractible. In other words, you can identify the facets somehow with these edges if you stare at it. There's a program, for example, Porta, you can find on the web, that will take convex hulls of things for you and just list everything you want to know about the convex hull. So if you take Porta and plug in this data, you'll get six facets which you recognize as corresponding to these six trentagons. And then you'll get 22, a total of 22, so the other facets. Six of them will be cycles like this cycle I've drawn here, and 10 of them will be cycles which are like one step longer. Like instead of taking this path, we could go up here, down for a detour along the long side of this pentagon and back up. And that's a one step longer cycle on the graph. And there are 10 such of those if you count. And so the polytope reveals combinatorial information that tells us all of the possible ways of doing something on the polytope, rather than a given one that would suffice to write down a minimal resolution in characteristic two. Okay? So that's one example. I want to close with a very simple ideal and talk about it, which again illustrates sort of, you know, how these kind of constructions enable you to talk to people at a conference that seemingly is in a completely different field and find out that you know things about the same thing, even though you're using completely different language to discuss the same thing. So the application I want to end with is graph theory. Okay? So let G be equal to a graph on n vertices. Okay. Now here's a graph G, and you know, so this one has 10 vertices. It's planar, okay? And define an ideal I to be the products xi, xj, the generators of I are the products xi, xj, where the edge I, comma j is an edge of G. Okay? And I is contained in the polynomial ring x1 through xn. Okay? So it fits into exactly the special, the entire theory of graphs from this point of view fits into exactly the special case that we're studying now, which is square free monomial ideals, minimal generators all the same degree. So we can ask what the minimal resolution looks like. We can also ask what the hull resolution looks like, and we know that the hull resolution is simply a way of interpreting a polytope, which is a convex hull, of the edges plotted suitably. Okay? So now we recognize this as being our Stanley-Reisner machinery. So I defines X, but what is X? X is a set of faces it's a set of faces of a superficial complex, but what do the faces stand for? Well, what they stand for is the vertices, no two vertices of F connected by an edge of G. Okay, so such sets F are well studied in graph theory and combinatorics. They go under the name stable sets, or if you want to think more in the language of matroid theory, you think of these as being independent sets. You should recognize both terminologies as discussing the same object. So there are various questions that one can ask. I mean, like a very simple relationship is that for us, you know, if we understand the Betti numbers, or any free resolution. I mean, if we completely combinatorially understand that, you know, any free resolution, such as the Hull resolution, or any other free resolution, or equivalently, if we can get a handle using these K sub Bs or anything we've talked about in the last 2 weeks as to what the Betty numbers are of this ideal, then that in particular gives you the Hilbert polynomial of X, which gives you the dimension of X, which gives you the size of the largest independent set. Okay, so that's a connection with graph theory. Now, there are several ways that you can read this. First of all, one can look at a pie-in-the-sky recreational math problem, which comes to mind whenever you say graph theory. So let me show you a theorem which you can find in Toft's article in the Handbook of Combinatorics as just a, as an aside that he makes. But he's a good reference for the rest of what I want to say also. The theorem says if G is planar, then G has a stable set on greater than or equal to n-fourth vertices. Okay. Does anybody recognize the four in this theorem? Okay. Four-color theorem, yes. Okay. Surprisingly, I mean, this is an offhand remark in this article, but surprisingly, there's only one known proof of this, which is the proof using the four-color theorem. In other words, you take a four-coloring of a planar graph, and each color picks out a stable set. So one way of thinking of a coloring of a graph is a decomposition of the graph into four or n or four or however many colors you're using, into disjoint stable sets whose union is the whole set of vertices of the graph. So pigeonhole principle, or however you want to think about it, if you've got four stable sets whose union is the set of all vertices of this graph, at least one of those stable sets has to have a quarter of the vertices in it. Okay? Now, one could hope to prove this theorem by understanding the dimension of X, but one imagines this is a fairly hopeless problem. And in fact, the word seemingly appears in that sentence, and something I tried to do, and I thought I was getting somewhere for a moment, and then it didn't work out. You should wonder, why would it be that this can only be proved by the four-color theorem? I mean, one possibility, which I'm sure people have looked at, but it probably hasn't, you know, I'm not aware of anyone having resolved it since the book came out, is perhaps you could come up with a construction from a given planar graph, build a much larger planar graph, such that stable sets of size n-fourths on the larger planar graph correspond to the colorings of the smaller planar graph, in which case you would prove that these two things were equivalent, in which case you would prove that an understanding of this simple ideal is what is required to give a hand proof for the four-color theorem. Now, I mean, who knows? But that's pie in the sky. I mean, people keep busy and try not to waste too much time on projects like that, especially, you know, you get papers out, you want to get jobs, you know, and so forth. But, I mean, what does happen in mathematics? And we study lots of special cases. So we've got a bridge between two countries here. And on one side, we have algebraic geometers who, like I said, when you show an algebraic geometer a set of Betty numbers of an ideal, they say, oh, yeah, that's the 2x2 minors of the, you know, and sort of start going off and they're like, you know, or that's an Egan-Northcott complex or, you know, I mean, so, you know, whenever I show Soren any of these Betty numbers, for special classes of graphs, you get resolutions for the minimal resolution that you recognize like that. Okay? So that's one side of the bridge. On the other side of the bridge is combinatorists have studied a set very similar to the set Hull of that ideal, which is instead you take the Hull of the incidence vectors of stable sets. I mean, just the, in other words, it's a 0-1 vector telling you by where the ones are which vertices are in your stable set. And you take The Grotschel is one paper which considers this, and all the references and a brief discussion of this appears in that article in the Handbook of Combinatorics. So, what is the relationship? Well, the elements of this set with maximal numbers of ones are the facets of the complex X we're looking at. Okay? On the other hand, the generators of our ideal are the minimal non-facets. Since they're all of the same degree, you would get exactly the same polytope if you complemented them. Instead of looking at those two entries, look at all the remaining entries. That's the same information. So in some sense, Alexander duality takes you between this hall and that hall. Now, Alexander duality is a well-used tool in topology, but we've been presenting the combinatorial form of it to you as if it's like completely natural and standard, and Anders Bjornner in particular has been using it for a long time in his work. Richard Stanley's been using the combinatorial form of it in his work for a long time. But to be completely honest, I mean, especially in commutative algebra, only in the last few years have we really started to appreciate, you know, all the consequences of Alexander duality in its combinatorial form. And there are plenty of other places where people just simply haven't asked, what happens if I Alexander dualize this combinatorial situation? So I'm not aware of anyone making the combinatorial change over to the Hall, which would connect with our work. But what do people do in this situation? They look at this polytope, and here's how the machine goes. You list inequalities which this convex hull, this polytope, must satisfy. In other words, you try to list faces, you try to list bounding hyperplanes which cut out this polytope. And for an arbitrary graph, you fail. I mean, if you understood for all planar graphs, you'd have a very good handle on at least this part of the planar graph problem. But for special classes of graphs, you prove that your half spaces of type A and C actually cut out the polytope. Or you prove that your hyperplanes of types B and C and D actually cut out the polytope. And those define special natural classes of graphs. So those people are studying special natural classes of graph. We're studying, oh yeah, let's take an Egan-Northcutt complex. But I mean, you know, somehow, I mean, occasionally one of those ideas breaks out and crosses over. So like when Richard Stanley proved the upper bound conjecture for arbitrary simplicial spheres, the crucial notion there was the notion of a Cohen-Macaulay ring, which didn't have an interpretation in combinatorics until he made that bridge. But once he proved that theorem, the notion Cohen-Macaulay as an idea in combinatorics is batted around all the time. So, you know, one should try to contact other civilizations and find out how they think about the math we think about, and try to start using the same language, because we just have more people to ask what's going on. Okay, so that's it for my part. Soren will thank you all for coming later.